Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Time to labrish. Getting in the groove here. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Margaret Marshall, your host of Backyard Labrish. I want to welcome you to the backyard and to really hope you're sitting in your favorite chair, chilling, and was really getting in the groove of that reggae music, because I know I was. Hope wherever you are calling in from or listening in from, it was a beautiful day in your city. It certainly was in mine. And right now, I am pretending I'm onto my favorite fruit tree, although my city is abloom in flowers. Beautiful springtime. But I am going to pretend I'm eating my East Indian mango under a big shady tree, and I'm really embracing the trade winds as they blow gently across my face. Oh, for those good old days. But tonight I'm very excited to share some wonderful news with you, because for my new listeners, you know I'm a senior citizen, senior, I call myself, and I am still like a child in a candy store when I discover new information about my culture that I never knew before. I am just so excited. And tonight, if you are on my list, you will know that we're talking about remarkable Jamaicans of the past. I mean, way back, much longer before my time, much before my time, and perhaps all of you listening now or who might come on later to listen. So I want to welcome our listeners on the board and also the ones listening online, because I think you're going to enjoy the information as much as I do. And if you do, I ask you to pass it on to your friends, because they can always check in the archives for favorite shows that they might want to listen to. So I think my fans know that the objective of Backyard Labrish is to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. Although we might not be living there, we're living all over the globe. But we still have fond memories, and we still cherish the thought and the idea and the knowledge that we were privileged to be born there. And tonight I'm going to share with you information that was brought to light by one of our Jamaican citizens who is not a native Jamaican, but Dr. Joy Lumsden, I think she's retired now. She was a professor at the university there and has been there for most of her life. And she is just wonderful in doing research. And I know how hard it must be to piece things together. But this, the information I'm going to share with you tonight is strictly from her websites. I did not find it in pieces of the past like I do a lot of my information or Wikipedia or wherever, but this was definitely from Dr. Lumsden. And they're just interesting, fascinating stories that really tells us about the spirit of just humanity and especially people that were born in Jamaica. Now, I know that most of our listeners know that there, you can find a Jamaican just about anywhere you go, any part of the world. There is perhaps at least one Jamaican there. However, I was fascinated to find out that this has been going on for a very long time, because I'm going to speak about three different Jamaican men who were born in Jamaica, raised in Jamaica, but ended up living most of their lives in another part of the world. And the first one I'm going to talk to has a famous last name, but I don't know that they are related. And he's Andrew Bogle. And Andrew was a black slave on the Hope Estate in St. Andrew, Jamaica. He was born around 1801. But nothing is ever said about his parents. He was taken to England in the mid-1820s by Edward Tichborne, who had for some time been managing the estate. Now, Tichborne apparently took Bogle with him without informing anyone of his intentions, which caused considerable annoyance, and employed him in England as his valet. Now, at first, Bogle lived with Tichborne and his new wife at Upton House near Poole in Dorset. Now, I've never been to England, and I have sidebars as I read these things, so I hope my listeners will understand that this is elaborate. We're here to enlighten, preserve, and, you know, celebrate. So put your hands up by hitting 1 on your telephone when you want to join the Labrish. But I am just reading casually from Dr. Lumsden's, you know, material from her website. So I see I have raised hand already from 404-421. So I am going to open the mic and welcome that listener. Just a minute here. Okay, here we are. Mic is open. Good afternoon. You're speaking to Margaret in the backyard. Who do I have? Hello? You raised your hand. 404-421. Okay, mic is closed.
Uh-oh.
Mic is open. Who do I have here? Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. This is Donna Robinson. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. Where are you calling from, Donna? Will you tell our audience?
I'm calling from Austell, Georgia, and I was just listening to your intro. And what did you say? His name was Andrew Bogle? How do you spell
it? B-O-G-L-E.
B-U-G-L-E. Oh, Bugle.
O-G-L-E.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay.
Andrew Bogle. Yes. So that's his name and from her documentation. Now, this is a very interesting story because, where was I now? Now, Tish, influenced by his employers, he was baptized in a Rome. Just a minute. Let me go back up. At first, Bogle lived with Tichborne and his new wife at Upton House near Poole in Dorset. This is in England, you know, he took him back. Influenced by his employers, he was baptized in the Roman Catholic Church. The Tichbornes were one of the oldest Catholic families in England at the time. At Upton in the 1830s, he married Elizabeth Young, a white English woman who had been a nurse in the household of Tichborne's aunt. The marriage took place in the Anglican church in the neighboring village of Great Canford, as at that time, Roman Catholic marriages were still not legally valid. Bogle and had two sons by his first marriage, John and Andrew, but his wife died in 1845. Now, first of all, it was interesting. I think one of my regular fans is into religion, so he knows what went on at different periods. But apparently, a Catholic marriage was not valid during those times. So even though he was baptized Catholic because of his employers, he had to be married. Remember now, this is a black slave. Marrying an English woman, he was married in an Anglican church. I found that quite interesting. Anyway, Andrew Bogle continued as Edward Tichborne's valet when, in the mid-1840s, this man, Tichborne, inherited a baronetcy and property. He became a baron. The family moved to the house, the property that he inherited was now in Hampshire. And the slave man, Bogle, and his two sons, John and Andrew, were sent to a Catholic school nearby Reading. In 1853, Sir Edward died. That's the man who inherited the property. And shortly after, Bogle was able to retire with a small pension. I found that very interesting. Now, he decided to migrate to Australia, possibly encouraged by another retired Tichborne servant who was living in Sydney. We're talking 1853. Now, before leaving, he married. Remember his wife died? At St. Peter's Roman Catholic Church now in Woodridge. He married Jane Fisher, the Dorset-born daughter of a soldier who had been a teacher at a village school near Tichborne's house. Now, his son Andrew went with them. John, he had two sons, remember, Andrew and John. Now, John was apprenticed to a chemist in Nottingham, but also traveled to Australia when his bad conduct brought about the end of that engagement. So I said, boy, even then, the parents were having problems with their teenagers, right? Bad behavior. Okay, so they're in Sydney now, right? In Sydney, Bogle for a time kept a restaurant, and his son started on careers. John continued as a chemist, and Andrew Jr. became a barber and hairdresser. Now, I found that so interesting because they mentioned barber and hairdresser. We're talking 18-something, right? The third son, Henry George, was born in 1856. However, in 1858, a common family tragedy befell Bogle. His wife, then aged 43, gave birth to another son, Edward, but died 3 weeks later of hemorrhage. The baby only lived 2 months. Now, Bogle himself began to suffer severely from rheumatism. Now, Bogle had remained in touch with the Tichbornes, you know, that is the Baron family, and so knew all about the problems caused by the disappearance of one of Sir Edward's nephews, Roger, who had been in line for the baronetcy and extensive property. Now, Roger's mother never believed that her eldest son had died in a shipwreck off the coast of South America in 1854. She clung to rumors that some survivors had been picked up by a ship on its way to Australia and had advertised in Sydney for any news of him. Bogle, remember that he used to work for them. So he, what he did was he got in touch with them and told, you know, the former employee's mother, and told them that he would have a lookout for this missing nephew that they claim died at sea. So that's how he reconnected, because he left, went to Sydney, but was hooked up because of this. Now, I'm just amazed at all the communication that could be sent and received, and there were all sorts of things going on in that period. So listen to what happened. In 1866, a man appeared out of the gold fields claiming to be the lost heir. Now, that's the one that was lost at sea. And he convinced Bogle now. Remember, the mother thought that he was picked up by a boat on the way to Australia. So she advertised there to find him, and Bogle picked up on that. Now, here comes a man out of the minefield, the gold fields, claiming to be this lost person. And he convinced this ex-valet of the family that he was indeed this person, Roger Titchmore. He had been well known as a boy. Now, Bogle knew him as a boy. Now, Bogle and his youngest son, Henry, now traveled back to England with this person who claims to be who he was. And he became deeply involved with the whole sorry business, as they mention here. Only Roger's mother accepted that this person claiming to be Roger was Roger. The rest of his family thought it was ridiculous. He didn't speak French, you know, and Roger was actually born in France. So only the mother, and I said to myself, just like a mother, to hold on and any hope that a child is alive. As I say, what I try to point out as I read these fascinating stories is how the human brain works. Because I'm sure other mothers online or now or that may come by and listen to the show would know how that is quite possible. That because the idea that your child was lost at sea and there were some survivors, and those survivors ended up in Australia. It was sort of ironic that this particular woman had this person, Bogle, who had moved to Australia. So now he comes back to England with this person who claims to be who he was. Well, the long and short of it is that the family of this baron person that was missing decided that the mother was wrong and they were right and this man was a fraud. However, Bogle got sucked in with this man, he and his son, believing that it was just his memory that was flawed and the man might have been the man that he knew. So he was on the person claiming to be Roger's side. Now, they're back in London, right? So listen to this part of the story. Now, they had it at that time, it was the longest case that they ever had legally. You know, it lasted 188 days. In legal history in England at that time, it was the longest case. Now, the claimant, who is this fraud person, he was defeated, and he and two supposed accomplices were given prison sentences. Now, it seemed fairly clear that he was really another person, Arthur Orton. They have his name here. And now the Chief Justice, who was Sir Alexander Cockburn, who presided over the trial, believed that Bogle had been honest, though mistaken in his evidence, and therefore not guilty of a crime. In other words, he could have been convicted with the other two who they thought were accomplices of this person who was pretended to be the Baron's heir. But the judge felt that Bogle was honest in his evidence, and he never sent him to prison. And I just thought that was quite a fascinating story. Now, let's see what happened to him. There's no record of when he died, really. But a movie was made, of that particular story in 1998. And they mentioned here that the movie implied then that Bogle was also guilty, but was never found guilty by the judge. The judge really thought that he was just misled by this man. So it says here, thus the saga of Old Bogle, the Jamaican ex-slave who had found himself at the heart of one of the most famous English legal issues of the 19th century, and who had been for a time one of the best known people in Britain. But the question of the actual nature of his support of the claimant still persists. The film made on the case in 1998 firmly insists that he was a co-conspirator with the accused. Isn't that something? I just thought that was a very fascinating story. And again, I am asking for any of the listeners on board that want to join the Labrish, just do so. But I wanted to give you a little sidebar of this person, Roger Charles Tichmore, as he's called. He was born in 1829 in Paris, actually, into a prominent Catholic family. King James I of England had made his ancestors, Sir Benjamin Tichmore, Sheriff of Southampton, a baronet in 1621. My God, listen to these dates. So that's how the connection came, when the man that took him from Jamaica, actually, got into this, became a baron, and then he inherited this property. So Dr. Joy Lumsden has details on, and she, one thing I can tell my listeners, that I feel very confident in the authenticity of her material, because she always have her documentation to back it up. And sometimes it's not everything that is on Wikipedia that is really supported, by strong documentation. But that is the story. She has links that tells you about all the different people, the mother, and how the Tichmores got into this royalty, how they became royalty or how they were part of royalty. But again, as I mentioned, it's so fascinating to know that in those times, people were, number one, traveling from England, from Jamaica to England, and living there, and then going to Australia. So that is the story of Andrew.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I must have missed it. How did they find out that this guy wasn't their heir? How did they do that?
Oh, well, actually, he didn't speak French, for number one. And as a boy, this person had had learned French. He was fluent in French.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't forget a language, I don't think, unless you have a brain damage. And number one, his features were completely different.
Mm-hmm.
He kept very few things. You know, his face, it goes into details in the articles to tell you why the case was decided against him. But actually, it's between the mother who just held on to the fact that her son was alive, and Bogle, who lived in Australia, and this man, I don't know if he perhaps, it's possible that he knew the connection between Bogle and this family.
Oh, I'm sure.
This man, Bogle, became quite famous. You know, they say he was well-known in Britain. Remember, he married an English woman first. Then they did not mention, the article did not mention what the second wife, you know, what her background was. But I am assuming they mentioned the daughter of a soldier. And I'm assuming it possibly was another English woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so his three sons were perhaps mixed.
So
and one of them, and then the last one, of course, didn't survive. But he had two sons with the first wife before mm-hmm. she died.
Yeah.
So to me, it was just very, very fascinating. But apparently this man got sentenced. I forgot what his sentence was. But he confessed that, you know, he retracted his story in 1895.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, you know, he a lot of people were on his side. A lot of people were, for some reason, he had a lot of supporters. And at one time in 1875, his supporters started a small-scale riot in London. Now, he served 10 years in prison and was released in 1884, by which time the public had forgotten him. It happens all over. He confessed in 1895, then later retracted, but aroused little interest. He died, this is the man, accused man, in poverty in 1898 and was buried at Paddington Cemetery in London, leaving behind a widow. But it's interesting because on his coffin, it has a plate with his name as the person he was impersonating, which was Roger Charles Tichborne.
Oh, he went down fighting, didn't he?
Yeah. Now, in 1913, a woman claiming to be his daughter, you know, was arrested because she was harassing the family that her father claimed he belonged to, you know, and she was sentenced to prison in 1923. But that's some fascinating story about a Jamaican-born.
He might have fooled her. I mean, you know, she might have been a young girl, and he's really, you know, acting this part out. She may have thought that, you know, he was for real or something.
Right. And I think some people on the board will, you know, he was a black slave on the Hope Estate in St. Andrew, Jamaica. You know, we are from the Kingston area are very familiar, not with the estate itself, but the Hope area. And I can see how that is part of Kingston, Donna. So people on the board or Jamaicans who are listening would know what area that was. But I thought that was a very fascinating story, and I hope that my listeners enjoyed it too. So now we're going to talk, and I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Backyard Library on Blog Talk Radio. We are here each Wednesday at 8 o'clock to do just that, to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve the rich, diverse culture of Jamaica, land we love. And if you're not on my mailing list, may I ask you to just give a comment on the radio, on this, if you're listening, go to the website. We do have a website, backyard, www.backyardlabrish.com, and leave us a comment or tell us what you'd like to labrish about, or please raise your hands and join the labrish. Now we're going to talk about another interesting Jamaican-born person who ended up somewhere else. This one is Billy Blue, spelled just like the blue we use to make our white clothes whiter, B-L-U-E, like the sky. Now, although Billy Blue's place and date of birth are uncertain, convicts' records suggest he was born in Jamaica around 1767. Okay. Now, by 1796, he was living in Deptford, London, and working as a chocolate maker and also laboring on ships on the Thames. On October 4th, 1796, he was convicted at Maidstone in Kent, listen to this, for stealing raw sugar and sentenced to 7 years transportation. Now, in those days, I understand from speaking to my cousin in Canada this evening that they didn't have prisons, so they would put them on a boat. I didn't know that. So, anyway, after serving over 4 years in the convicts' hulks, the ships used for housing criminals, that's what it was called, H-U-L-K-S, he was transported to Botany Bay, Australia, in the convict ship, Minora, Minora, he was described in the ship's record as a Jamaican Negro sailor, aged 29, in 1796. Now, he arrived in Sydney in 1801, and served out the remaining part of his sentence. In 1804, records show him living in the Rocks, then a very tough part of the city. There he met Elizabeth Williams, a 30-year-old convict from Hampshire, England, who had arrived in June of 1804. On April 27th, 1805, they were married at the old St. Philip's Anglican Church in Sydney, where five of their six children were later christened. Ain't that something? He is born in Jamaica, ends up working in England, ends up being convicted, put on a boat, and ends up in Australia. I'm telling you, it's really, really something else. And as I say, I can't even imagine what transportation was like, you know, how long it took to get from one place to the next in those days, because the ships weren't like the ships of today. And I'm sure it took it was long and tedious. But the thing is that these men seem to have so much tenacity and strength, because they were always, they never faltered at whatever they were doing, even if it wasn't good. But, it just tells you that no matter what culture you're from, no matter what country you're from, basically the brain and the body works the same. I mean, you have the same organs, the same thinking capabilities, and a lot of time, you know, how things work out is really part of your upbringing, and you know, your younger days, the values or lack of them that you get. But the most famous, and to me, the most interesting, I left for the last. And I really want to to honor this person. And I know a lot of people, and I think some people can relate to some of these last names because, well, these people ended up in one in Australia. The first two ended up in Australia. So there's perhaps some of their, you know, descendants still floating around someplace. And it's, I wondered really, in some of Dr. Lumsden's notes, she mentioned, I'm not sure for one of them, that she heard about the story. I think it was Billy Blue, but I wouldn't swear on it, that she visited Australia 20 years ago, when she, 20 years before she wrote this, got, or put together this information, and she had heard the story there and then started some research on it. Which brings me to the fact that I always mention the reason for me doing this show is to help some of the seniors, and I will say again that I'm a senior's senior, and I encourage people in my generation and younger and even older to leave some sort of personal record about things that inspired them or helped to make them who they are. Because your ancestors might not be interested now. I mean, the generation that we're living with now may not seem interested. But as they get older, who knows, that might change. And having something in your own words is going to be so much more meaningful to them than having someone else piece something together about you. So with that said, I really, really would like to encourage everybody, I mean, whether they're in my age group or not, but if you are a parent or a grandparent or, you know, you have something that is meaningful in your life that you think would be interesting or helpful to another generation, then the best way to preserve it is to put it in outer space. And that is the internet. And it can be very private. You don't have to make it open to the public. So, and we have that facility on backyardlabrish.com if you care to utilize it. So, with that said, I am going to now tell you about Henry Phillips. And this is a very interesting story. And I'm sure it may be interesting to you, Donna, because he ended up in Philadelphia.
Oh, it
was very interesting. And some of his information was put together by people here in Atlanta that was doing historical stories. So Henry Phillips, Phillips, it's spelled. I know that people spell their names differently. And he was born in 1847. Now, he recorded in an autobiography. He wrote about himself. Isn't that great? In 1939. I figured he was 92 years when he was doing that. Now, he was born in St. Elizabeth, Jamaica, on March 11th, 1847. He said he knew this because it was written in the family Bible. And I know from my experience that that is the way my mother recorded a lot of her information, in the family Bible. Unfortunately, the family Bible that I had, of course, was consumed in the fire that I had. So I have none of those records anymore. So here again is my sidebar to the people who are preserving memories. Having it in your home or in your car or in your head ain't going to get it preserved. Please, please do it another way, because now we have a tool that was not available to my mother and to all the people that I've read about. So we have no excuses. So let's get it done. Okay, now here is what he wrote. First remembrance of myself. How old? Don't know. Mother puts on pantaloon on me. what a great man I was on that day. As children, we had to work during the day. We had no short days and long nights as you have in North America. Days 12 hours long, nights the same. Now, that pantaloon, well, I remember when Father gave me a little gun. I loaded it, went out one day, rested it on a fence, fired at a pet Cammy, first cousin to a nightingale. Oh, I didn't know that. C-A-M-Y. He's talking about a bird. First cousin to a nightingale, and shot it. As I saw it fall, I threw the gun down, jumped over the fence, ran through the tall foxtail grass, and took it up. How did I feel? I felt that I was a great hunter, like the mighty Myrod that we read about in the scriptures. Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
This is from a 92-year-old man writing about this in 1939. Ain't that something?
Wow.
So fascinating. I'm not finished. It's raining. We children are running about in old clothes. Now we are in fields. Now in the pond, disturbing the ducks. What sport? Now we are carrying cane to the sugar cane mill. We carry everything on our heads. It is night. What little reading or studying we do is done by candlelight. Many a candle have I made. How? Take a bamboo joint. Fix your string so as to have it in the middle. Pour melted wax into it. Let it become cold. Split the joint open, and behold, your candle ready for use. U-S-E. I'm reading it just like it's written. Now you have your dim and flaming light, in parenthesis. Of course, it is not electric light, but you have had the pleasure of making your own light, a pleasure that you can never get out of your use of electricity. Besides sugarcane, we planted ginger. When I was about 12 years old, in my spare time, I peeled enough ginger with which a horse was bought for me. Again, I was a great man, riding on my own horse. We raised our own horses, cows, mules, and donkeys. There was much pleasure in caring for them. But was it always pleasure? No. Life is not made up that way. It would be monotonous if we were so. We enjoyed light because there is darkness. Many a fall I have had from a donkey. Many tears I have shed because of a stubborn mule or donkey. Ain't that something? I am so fascinated by this man. There was hard work and plenty of fun in selling ginger or sugar. The parish of St. Elizabeth, where we lived, was some distance from my seaport town where we had to take our produce. Horses or mules took them in hampers. We may start one afternoon, travel half the night, unload, rest, reload, and enter town in the morning. Returning had more fun for it because we could ride home. Rum, we made plenty of Jamaican rum, but I am not a rummy, a teetotaler then. Oh, no. Simply had no taste for liquor. Hence, I hesitate to judge one who has. I am not tempted as he is. I must be careful how I judge. And in parenthesis, it says, judge not, and you shall not be judged. Isn't that something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's from his autobiography. Anyway, here is just the rest of the story about him, which is very, very fascinating. And again, listeners, I see we have listeners from 631. I want to welcome you. 451. We have a Skyper. We have two Skypers Skyping in. And I'm not sure where that is from. And if you want, anybody want to join the Labrish, raise your hands. And, of course, we have 718-379. Okay, now let's hear a little bit about Mr. Henry Phillips. In 1862, Henry Phillips was sent to the Moravian Training School at Fairfield in the neighboring parish of Manchester. He spent 6 years at Fairfield and gives a very interesting account of how the studies were. He clearly felt that he owed much to the very intense training he received at Fairfield, especially in how to live a disciplined and productive life. He graduated in 1868 and immediately went to teach in St. Croix in the Danish Virgin Islands. After 2 years there, he resigned, and against the advice of his pastor and friends who thought he should go to study in Germany, went to New York. Arriving there on September 15, 1870, he went straight on to Philadelphia, which was to be his home for the rest of his long life. Ain't that something?
Yeah.
Okay. So here it is now. At the age of 15, I entered the Moravian Training School. This is he loved to write. The Moravian Training School at Fairfield, Manchester Parish. That is some distance from the parish in which I was born. The climate is noted for its health-giving power. I didn't even know that. Now, though born in a Moravian family, one grandmother was a Roman Catholic. On that account, I was baptized by a Roman Catholic priest. How old was I? I don't know. But I was old enough to remember the appearance of the baptizer. I remember his long black skull cap, father, and his name is spelled Dupeyron. Dupeyron, he was called Dupeyron. That's how they called him, what they called him. The baptism was not in a church. I do not remember as a child ever having been in a Roman Catholic church. I went to a Moravian parish school and church. In 1864, at Fairfield School, I was received into church fellowship by means of a solemn and impressive service. That began my training for confirmation. I was confirmed October 14, 1866. The soul training was such as probably I could not have gotten anywhere else. Now, then it tells you about Fairfield School, which I'm going to read about a little bit. But from what I gathered, if he was born in 1864, he was 17 when he was at this Fairfield School. And he was 19 years old when he was confirmed. So he was quite a teenager. Now, Fairfield Training School had a large number of acreage of land. There were about 30 of us in the buildings. There was but one cook, and her place was in the kitchen. Servants to do the work? Oh, no. We were our own servants, and there never could be any loafing. We got up in the morning by the clock. We worked by the clock. We ate by the clock, we studied by the clock, and we went to bed by the clock. Everything about the houses and grounds were kept in a state of perfect condition. Every morning, except Sunday, the most of us did some work about the grounds. But clothes had to be washed, dried, and mangled, M-A-N-G-L-E-D. I wonder what that meant. I thought, yeah, just press them or iron them. But he said mangled. Okay, we did that. Sometimes wells went dry. We must bring water from the nearest place where it could be had. All kinds of fruits and vegetables were cultivated. Every student had a small patch of land given him that he owned. Huh, interesting. On Wednesday afternoons, each student cultivated his own piece of ground. What he raised, he sold to the institution. Not many of us, if any, had parents sending them money. Hence, it can be seen how diligently each one cultivated his patch. Saturday mornings, we did not work in the fields. What did we do? We swept the floors, scrubbed them, rubbed them with wax, and then shined them. And everything had to be done in a perfect manner. There was a monitor going about, peeping into every corner to make sure that every spot was clean. Before that, all the cots and beds were taken out, sunned, and cleaned. The afternoon was our own. Games, cricket especially, was played. And most Jamaicans can relate to that because cricket was always the order of the day. You know, because you didn't need much. You need a little bat and a ball and a long plot of grounds. So that was interesting. At dinner, one student had to read. Everything was done as far as possible in a perfect manner. All my teachers, except one from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, was from Europe. And as I remember, Persian discipline meant doing everything in the best possible way. We stood aghast when we heard of some of the things that American students did with us. The last breach of discipline meant probably dismissal from college, and to have been dismissed from Fairfield Training School was looked upon as being disgraceful, as to be hanged for a crime committed. One of my many duties at school was to take care of the roses. I still see at this writing, 72 years later, some of the beautiful English tea roses that I used to nurse. I love flowers. I see so much of the face of God in them. It was probably because of early training. Train up a child in time way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. Immediately after graduation, I left home to teach in St. Croix or Santa Cruz. It was then a Danish island. That was April 12, 1868. He was 21 years old. Isn't that something? I am so fascinated by this story. And, you know, it goes on a little longer. But I want to take a break from the reading and just share with my listeners all that I have learned and am inspired by when I go back in history and really read about, you know, some of the remarkable people. And as I say, this would not have been brought to light if it was not for that wonderful Jamaican resident who was really born and raised in England and married a Jamaican and is still there. And I'm hoping that one of these days she will join me on the show because I use her material so often. But again, I want to welcome all the listeners on the board, and I see that everybody's hanging with me, so I'm assuming that they're all enjoying these stories. So now I am going to tell you a little bit more about this wonderful gentleman. Now, here's a note about Fairfield itself. The school was started, Fairfield was started about 1839 in the house of Jacob Zorn, Z-O-R-N. the Moravian superintendent with three young men who studied the three R's, the Bible, and gardening. F.R. Holland joined the staff in 1841, and carpentry was added to the curriculum. There was then 10 students. Now, Phillips went 2 years at the Moravian Missionary House studying Hebrew and working at a mission in North Philadelphia. He also experienced frost and snow for the first time. In 1872, he enrolled at the Philadelphia Divinity School, then located in a modest-sized private house. This was an Episcopalian theological college, and there is no explanation given of the reasons for becoming an Episcopalian. He remembered especially. Now, the differing but equally effective teaching styles of two professors, and he names them Professor Goodwin, who encouraged wide-range discussion, and George Elmer Heer, who encouraged all questions during class time. So he finished his training in the summer of 1875 and was ordained deacon by Bishop Stevens shortly afterwards. Now, in December of 1875, he married Sarah Elizabeth Cole, whose sister Rebecca J. Cole was the second African-American woman to qualify as a medical doctor. Dr. Cole received her education at the Institute for Colored Youth in Philadelphia and the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania. So, Donna, I don't know if you're familiar with that name, Rebecca J. Cole. She, in this, it says that she was the second woman to be become a doctor. Were you familiar with that name? Donna, are you there? I guess not. Excuse me?
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I wasn't. Wasn't familiar with her. But you know what's interesting for me was this guy who, Henry Phillips, I'm looking at this other thing that, you know, on the internet, and it actually has him born in 1847, died in 1947, 100 years old. But anyway, it was talking about him, and it's saying that, I mean, you think about the time. I mean, I was like, my goodness, look at that.
That's what is fascinating me, the timing of all this, because we all know what was going on here then.
And what is a Moravian? Do you know what that is?
It's a form of religion. It's a form of religion that would be similar to the Methodists, I guess. But we had Moravian churches out in Jamaica. You didn't have them here?
No,
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
well,
it's
on the board
and
have a better explanation of what is a Moravian or what anything about the Moravian church and how it operated. I just know that we had Moravian churches in Jamaica. I don't really know whether they're close to Methodists, Anglicans. I know they weren't Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where they originated either, but I know that they were in Jamaica. And apparently they had quite a presence because, you know, this superintendent was, he started the Fairfield thing going.
Now, do you have that little side note where it talks about how he transformed the church?
Oh, yes, I have that. That is part of my next reading.
Okay.
But he, in 1876, Henry Phillips was ordained to the priesthood of Holy Church, where he had served as a lay reader. The Negro priest of the longest service in the Episcopalian Church is one of the most valuable social reformers of the day. And that was a quote by the Reverend Phillips of Philadelphia. I mean, about him. I mean, And did you see, Donna, where is the Atlanta University Press in 1903 that did some documentation on his contributions to the whole religious and social aspect of, body of Philadelphia, which I don't know about other Jamaicans, and I don't even know if people in Philadelphia now that might be still associated with this church or, you know, whatever is remaining of it, that originally this man was born and educated in Jamaica. I just find it very fascinating because most of his work and his life was dedicated to the church in Philadelphia. And I had never heard, not that I know everything, but there is no, besides this information that Dr. Lumsden has on our website, there's not even, I don't know of any in the documentation that the Gleaner Company has in pieces of the past. And I happen to have an encyclopedia that I quote from about Jamaica quite often, and he's not mentioned in it. So I thought this was very, very interesting information. And as Dr. Lumsden addresses these people, and there are several of them with interesting, very interesting lives that she has pieced together. But for me, it was interesting that all of these people seem to have been born there and lived some of their lives in this deacons or this priest, as they're called in the Episcopalian churches. They refer to him as a Negro priest in the American documentation, but that he got his basic and most of his education in Jamaica. Now, I have here, it says the Negro Church Report of a social study made under the direction of Atlanta University, together with the proceedings of the 8th Conference for the Study of the Negro Problems, held at Atlanta University on May 26, 1903, and was edited by, you know, whoever. But after his ordination, Henry Phillips served for a little over a year at the Church of St. Thomas near 5th and Walnut Street. He described it as an aristocratic church, and Du Bois said it represented the most cultured and wealthiest of the Negro population and the Philadelphia-born residents. He began his first service. Listen, I thought this was quite interesting. He began his first service at the church promptly at 10:30 a.m., only to be told by the organist afterwards that he should have waited until she played a voluntary when there were enough people in the congregation for the service to start. Now, Phillips, remember he was brought up under the strict training in Jamaica, right? Yeah. Phillips said that his Fairfield training could not accept that, and the congregation would have to put up with getting to church on time.
Oh.
And they said the congregation happily accepted services that started on time thereafter. He only stayed at St. Thomas for about 17 months and was married in the church in December of 1875. But what I thought was interesting, that although it is said that when in Rome, do as the Romans do, he said, nah, I'm starting this service on time. And I thought that quite outstanding. Now, he had hoped to be able to go as a missionary to Liberia or Haiti, but neither was proved possible. He received offers from the South and one in New Orleans, but he was not prepared to accept them. For a time, he ran a school, which did well, but soon the opportunity turned up, which decided his future. It was suggested to him that he should inquire about the possibility of becoming rector of the Church of Crucifixion. The other colored Episcopal Church in Philadelphia at the time. He was well known to the 12 white members of the church vestry, as he had been a Sunday school teacher and lay reader there while he was an ordinant. So he met with the rector's warden, who explained that the church owed money to the previous rector, and that there was no money to pay him. He immediately accepted the job and remained at the Church of Crucifixion, a rector, for 25 years. In the Philadelphia Negro W.E.B., Du Bois wrote in 1899 of the Church of Crucifixion and its rector. This is what this man wrote. The oldest of the churches in St. Thomas, next comes the Church of Crucifixion, over 50 years old and perhaps the most effective church organization in the city for benevolent and rescue work. It has been built up virtually by one Negro, a man of sincerity and culture and of peculiar energy. This church carries on regular church work at Bainbridge and 8th, and at two branch missions. It helps in the Fresh Air Fund, has an ICE mission, whatever that means, a vacation school of 35 children, and a parish visitor. It makes an especial feature of good music, and its vested choir. One or two courses of university extension lectures are held there each year, and there is a large beneficial and insurance society in active operation and a home for the homeless on Lombard Street. This church especially reaches after a class of neglected poor whom the other colored churches shun or forget, and for whom there is little fellowship in white churches. And that was what was written about his church at the time in 1899. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and they say he and his wife visited Jamaica on several occasions in 1902, in 1911, and in 1922. And this is what Dr. Lumsden is saying, and there is little reference to their visit, appear in the Gleaner Company. Apparently, the Gleaner didn't recognize him as any, force to write about, because there's no documentation, and she gets a lot of her information from the newspaper, you know what I mean? So I just had a very great time researching and just mulling over all these times and the ages of these people and everything in my mind. I see we have a raised hand and someone else would like to join the Labrish. Excuse me. So I'm going to open up the mic and welcome this caller. Good evening. We've got Margaret in the backyard who would like to join the Labrish.
Good evening, Margaret and Donna. This is Janine from Long Island.
Hi, Janine. Welcome to the backyard.
Yes, I'm here. I found it very amusing interesting that he was early for service, because unlike most Jamaicans, we are always late.
Well, this is now Jamaicans. He was in a different time.
Oh.
And as he said, we're in Fairfield, it was so disciplined.
Yes.
Everything was by the clock, remember? We eat by the clock, we wake by the clock, we work by the clock.
Right, right.
So it was ingrained, which brings me, Janine, to the fact that, repetition forms habits.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing something over and over and over and over the same way that becomes a habit.
Right.
And he was so schooled. in the being precise at whatever he did that it, I suppose he just couldn't buy into the fact that he had to wait till enough people, because that's what the organist was trying to tell him.
Right.
That there has to be enough people in the congregation and she would play this special music, then he'd start.
Right, right. But so, I guess he was so anxious to start that.
Yeah, well, I think it's more like because he was just so disciplined.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So let's start even if there's one person. But sooner or later, the congregation picked up on it.
He was going by his time.
Right,
his clock.
That was
the most important thing to him.
Timing. So what can we take away from all these stories? Because, you know, when you think back, whether it was 18, whatever, or 19, whatever, or now, some of the same things are happening, aren't they?
Yeah, well, you know, it was interesting. I mean, he had a home, a house for the homeless, a homeless like shelter, and, you know, how progressive he was within his own community. If somebody, if you get a chance, you might want to look at him, Henry L. Phillips. I mean, he's really kind of distinguished looking. I mean, the way his beard is and his, his you know, uniform or whatever. I mean, just really very distinguished and very confident in who he was. And, I mean, it was, you know, it's just kind of interesting, you know, that because he was, well, and then the other guy that, you know, Bill, I mean, interesting when you see they had a little photo of him. Looks like he just has some blue jeans on and, you know, like a vagabond kind of guy. You know, just I'm here today. He had a little bag slinged over his shoulder. And,
another what? Another minute?
You know?
Well, you know, nothing beats the environment when you're young and coming up and the things that become important to you. So obviously, you know, the schooling that he got when he was a teenager, you know, and before, because it talked about his grandmother, you know. And I want to use all of those points to just encourage the listeners that might be from my time or a different time or young or it doesn't matter, to take from all of these stories of our past. I am just happened to be doing Jamaica's past, but, you know, everybody and every culture and every country have a past. So wherever you are from, you might be listening to the show, you know, there are so many lessons that we can learn from people who lived long before us that can help to strengthen the character, and we can build on the good things that you can never outgrow or will never go away once they're carried down from generation to generation. And it is important. You know, it really is important. So although, you know, at times we want to give up on the youth and feel that it's not worth it or we don't have the time or we can't be bothered or it's useless, it never is. It never is. Because I'm sure all during this time that he was involved in the things he was, there were a lot of people who weren't. But one person can make a difference. Because I learned so much when we did the research on the origination of the Salvation Army. Because that is still such a vibrant organization in every part of the world that was started by one couple in England. You know, that just the wife and husband decide that they're going to do this. And look where it is today. So with that, I want to encourage all our listeners, we just have a few more minutes, to just take from these stories of the past and, you know, mull them over and ask yourself, what can I do or what do I want to preserve about me? What do I want to pass on? Perhaps something I got from one of my people who was before me that I want to pass on to the next generation. And how can I do that? And with that said, I am going to tell you that this research that I did on these three people have just opened up a new can of worms for me, because there are so many of them with such interesting stories who they might not have ended up where they were born, but all of them were born or at some time had some schooling or lessons or so in Jamaica. So I am very, very inspired by all of this, and I want to tell all our listeners, those that communicate with me by putting up their hands and those who don't, how much I appreciate them just for being here. And I would continue to ask you to spread the word about the Labrish so that more people can participate and more people can help me to celebrate, enlighten, and preserve. And with that said, I just wanted to tell you a little story that happened a couple of days ago. Some time ago, I had a guest. Her name, I'm not going to necessarily say her name, but she had a show on last year. And she called me up a couple of days ago and said, "Margaret, I have a cousin who lives in Sweden and has been living there for some time. And guess what? They sent me information on your show." And I said to her, "Aren't you ashamed of yourself that you didn't send it to them? They send it to you." I'm saying that to say, if you come across a show that you think would be interesting, and they're all archived by the month, you can go to, on the, if you're going, you can go to Blog Talk website and Google Backyard Labrish, and the page will come up with the logo, which is our national bird. Right to the left, to the right, you will see all the months, and you can go in each month and look for a show that might be interesting and listen to it. They're all there. And we ask you to share it with your family that may be living abroad someplace or in Jamaica someplace that might be of interest to them, so that, you know, the word can be spread about what we're trying to do here. But I thought that was quite interesting that she lives in the same city I do, and she was really tickled that her relative in Sweden was informing her about the show that she was already a guest on. So with that said, I want to thank Janine and Donna for participating. I want to thank all the other callers who have Skyped in and called in and are listening online for being a part of the Labrish tonight, and to remind you to come back next week, because next week we have some more interesting stories of some of the Jamaican-born people of the past. So with that said, do our open mic folks have any parting words for the rest of the world? Janine?
Well, again, you did it. It was really interesting. And with Bogle, the first one, if I could go back a little, I assume the reason why he was unable to marry the first time in the Catholic Church, that maybe his first wife was already married, because in the Catholic Church, you cannot, if you're divorced, you can't marry, even if it's just one person. So that's an assumption, you know.
Right, right, right. Well, it mentioned here that at the time, which was in the 1830s,
right,
Catholic marriages were not legally valid, because, you know, the Church of England was the king.
Right.
Of, you know, they issued all the rules and regulation, and they were not about to recognize the Catholics, I suppose. And I see that my religiously astute fan from the Bronx, I think, has his hand up, so I'll let him comment on that.
Right.
I'm going to open his mic. Good evening. Who do I have? This is Margaret in the backyard.
Yeah, this is Leigh from the Bronx, the home of the New York Yankees, world champions in the United States.
Thank you, sir.
I just wanted to remind you that initially there was virtually one religion, even though there are so many religions in Jamaica. The state religion was the Anglican, later to be called Episcopalian. But this is prior to what do you call it, when we broke away, became independent, prior to independence, that's what I wanted to say.
Right. It's interesting because this man went to England in 1830. He wasn't in Jamaica when he got married, actually. He was in London.
Yeah.
He was in, and his wife was from Dorset.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, wherever that is, I am not familiar with the, you know, the demographics of England and London. But it was in the 1930s when he married this Elizabeth Young, a white English woman who had been a nurse in the household of the Baron person.
And what also struck me is that it took a Jamaican to head to Australia.
Right.
And everybody that was going to Australia in
a convict
times, right, exactly. So
but he opened a restaurant. You know, how smart. I don't know the convicts. It's once they got off the ships, they went there and what they did.
And in those days, the community of people in Australia, even though they sort of cleansed themselves and became citizens of the country, were still convicts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Australia has a history of being a sanctuary for convicts.
Right. Well, actually, they used to send them there on ships.
That's correct.
You know, so that's the whole thing.
Jamaican got on a ship and got there too.
Right. And he wasn't convicted of anything. He was lucky to get off of the case, though, because they really thought he was conspiring with this fraud man.
Yeah.
But the judge felt that he was sincere. And in other words, you know, the man, as we would say in Jamaica, the man Sam Fahim.
Listen, I think you ought to solicit your audience to write in some more stories like this. It's very interesting.
Oh, I was so fascinated, and I want to honor, really, Dr. Joy Lumsden. I send her a link each time I plan a show, and I hope that she does have time to listen, and I'm sure that you'll all join me in just telling her how much we appreciate the work she continues to do.
Yeah. Okay.
Because without her research and piecing things together, a lot of things we would not know.
Yeah, I think I'd like to track her down next time I go there.
Yes, well, yes. But you know, she has a whole lot of interesting people, quite a few more that I will feature. This is part one, but there's also a woman involved in this remarkable people, and I haven't read her story yet, but I'm sure that it will be quite interesting.
Well,
so
I
with
hope
that,
it's, I hope
huh?
it's the same one I'm thinking, but when you reveal it, I will let you know.
Oh, okay. But I'm glad that everybody enjoyed those remarkable Jamaicans and their fascinating stories. And, you know, we know that there right now as we speak, there are several younger than us lay Jamaicans that are doing some fantastic work. In different fields. Yeah, right. So, you know, I don't have enough time to talk about everybody, but I just hope everybody's really, really enjoying the enlightening part of the information. Because I know all of this is online and people can really research it and find it. But who has time, you know? Because while people are listening to me on the radio, they can be doing something on their computer, or they can be, you know, in their homes, and they don't have to be doing the research themselves. So
yeah.
I consider just doing it for the rest of the world that have an interest.
Yeah, just wanted to say good night to y'all and Donna and Janine and
good night.
Madge
good night.
Marshall.
Good okay,
night.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Miss Janine, you have anything to say?
Well, I just did. I said congrats again. You did.
Oh, well, thank you.
That was very interesting.
Right, great, great. Miss Donna?
I just want to say that, you know, one of the things that I did when I put in Billy Blue, Jamaican, and an Australian dictionary of biography came up online with him, and it has just a lot of information in it. It was kind of interesting. It was Australian dictionary.
Right, because, you know, he ended up there.
Right, right.
That's where he lived, you know, most of his life. So.
Yeah, yeah. So
there's not a place in the world that you won't find a Jamaican. And with that said, Jamaicans will understand what I mean when I say, we little but we talawa. And I want to bid you all a great night. And as always, make it a fantastic week. Good night.
Good night.